Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. With me in the studio, obviously, is my producer, Mr. Dan Arnfeld. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hello.
Well, I do have a comment, and this is from Karen Cooler. And Karen, I'm so glad to hear from you. This is a little bit of a different comment. She's not praising me so much, but she's telling me about another Churchill book. And she says, hi, I was watching the latest podcast from Carolyn Glick. And towards the end, she was talking about a book that she just read about Winston Churchill called The Splendid and the Vile. Sounds interesting. Is this in your list for the JBL show? Thanks. Well, here's one thing I want to say, Karen, and to everyone else listening out there. I looked up the book. I haven't read it. It doesn't look like it's all that expensive. But one of the things I just want everyone to be a little careful with is we're talking about Winston Churchill was really a great statesman. And just to have the title, The Vile, The Splendid and the Vile, makes me not recommend the book. So Karen, what I am going to do, I'm going to get the book for myself. I'm going to read it, and I'm going to see if it's worthy of Just the Best Literature. And if it's not, I will tell you. So anyway, but thanks, Karen, for listening in. And I know you're a regular listener. Now, on our last program, I began discussing chapter 7, titled The Blackest of All Days, and that is from part 2, Into Africa. Now, besides, as I was getting ready for the program today, besides giving us the history of the British War with the Boers, this chapter also gives us the description of Winston Churchill's devastating news on his arrival at Cape Town's Table Bay on the ship, the Dunotter Castle. And so I found some interesting things in the book that I hadn't read yet. So we can kind of mash them together and come up with a good podcast today. Now, for today's podcast, I want to continue discussing a new section of Chapter 7, which is titled The Blackest of All Days. Now, remember from previous programs, and I know we haven't been maybe as regular as we should. Fall break is finally over. Classes are starting this week. And of course, those of you that are members of the church know we're all at the Feast of Tabernacles, and that's over. And so, it's time to get ourselves back in the flow of doing work and all of that. So, but again, remember, the British believed they would have an easy fight against the Boers, and as I stated previously, the Boers were well prepared for the coming fight. Now, what I want to do today is I want to begin on the middle of page 78. And again, this is chapter 7. And I just want to read you the top three items. Remember now, this is what Churchill and everybody that they finally were getting closer and closer to being in South Africa. And then they saw another ship and they had bad news on the ship. And they said the Boers were defeated, which would have been a positive thing for the British. There were three battles. And then it says Penn Simmons was killed. Now, our last program, we dealt with why Penn Simmons was killed. And it's because he was arrogant and he wouldn't follow the rules and the tactics that he had been raised with. Now, again, this was awfully shaking to all the men that were on the Dunotter Castle. And so, but if you really read through the chapter slowly and don't try and get through it too fast, there's some other things in there that are really interesting. So the British believed they would have an easy fight. They were shocked. The British on the Dunnottar Castle were shocked to see that one of their famous leaders, military leaders, was dead. So this is all, it was all shocking for them. Now, if we go on, like into page 78, I want to just go down to the second paragraph. And I'm going to read these first three or four paragraphs on this page 78, just to get us in the mood. But it also reveals some things from Churchill that I think you need to understand before we really get into him fighting at the Boers. This is the second paragraph. It says, as the ship swiftly disappeared from sight, taking with it the answers to their many desperate questions, Churchill, never shy about making his opinion known, openly complained that it would only have taken 10 minutes to have stopped the ship and got proper information. Buller, with his characteristic phlegm, dryly replied that it was the weakness of youth to be impatient. So this is his boss. This is the boss. And he's telling him, you're an impatient youth. Churchill did not like that at all. He said, we should know everything has happened quite soon enough. Churchill, however, everything that had happened quite soon enough, Churchill, however, although not even a soldier, let alone the commander-in-chief, remained impenitent and unconvinced. So he is not happy with Buller. And we're going to hear a little bit more about that as we go on. Now, the next day, when the Dunnottar Castle arrived at Cape Town's Table Bay and waited to be pulled into the harbor, Churchill watched hungrily as a tugboat ran alongside the ship and a man stepped aboard. He was, in Churchill's words, not just any man, but a man who knew. And so one of the things we have to understand about Winston Churchill, his mind was always on, how can I get ahead? How can I do better? How can I get the fight in this war? Remember now, he's there as a journalist. He's not there as a part of the army. And but he saw there was a man who knew, and this man knew a lot more about the war, and he just thought that they should have, driven right up beside it and got a hold of him. He said, it was the moment Churchill had been waiting for since leaving Southampton 2 weeks earlier, and he was determined to extract every last bit of information there was. Now, the other thing that Candace tells us, Churchill was not alone in his impatience. Surrounded by nearly 300 soldiers and journalists, the man was practically chased across the oil floorboards until he reached the ladder leading into the hurricane deck. Quickly climbing the rungs, he chose a step halfway up and took a seat. Only then, with an old quiver of excitement in his voice, did he finally tell his story. So one thing you're going to find out, Winston loves stories, especially stories he can use. And so he says, while his audience stood transfixed, the man described one battle after another and had already been fought between the Boers and the British. Every major battle but Ladysmith, which was taking place as he spoke. Finally, after listening to tales of stubborn, well-fought fights with honor for both sides, triumph for neither, one man in the audience asked the question that was on all of their minds. Tell us about the losses, he said. Who are killed and wounded? And so remember now, the Boers, even though they look stupid, they really took the British army down. It was not the best win for the British. Churchill goes on to say, it was a stunningly long list, Churchill would later remember, a list of the best officers in the world. As the names of friends, mentors, fathers, and brothers were read out loud, the men who had gathered eagerly at the foot of the ladder began to turn one by one and hurry away, overcome with emotion that they did not want their fellow soldiers to see. So the list was daunting, and it was also, I'm sure, friends. friends of these men that were still alive. And they were just totally emotionally moved into tears. It says Churchill himself, Candace says, Churchill himself knew several of the men on the list, all lying under the stony soil or filling the hospitals at Pietermaritzburg and Durban. But one name in particular leaped out at him, meaning Winston Churchill, with a painful jolt of recognition, was the name Almer Haldane. Now, this is the title I've made for this program is Winston Mourns the Death of Almer Haldane. And I think this is a genius, I think, inclusion by Candace Millard of the book. And she really does show that Winston may have been a little arrogant. He may have been a little, above board on many things. But when it came to this friend, Almer Haldane, it just shows that Churchill really does have a soft, really soft side. It says, and here's how she explains this. So Churchill had met Haldane the year before when he was trying to persuade Sir William Lockhart, then commander-in-chief of Her Majesty's Army in India, to let him fight on the northwest frontier. So now we're going all the way back to India, where he met this young soldier, Almer Haldane. It says, Haldane, who was Lockhart's aide-de-camp, had at first been none too cordial. Churchill remembered, but for a reason that Churchill could not quite understand, his attitude had abruptly and completely changed. I don't remember what I said, nor how I stated my case, Churchill wrote later, but I must have hit the bullseye more than once, for after about a half an hour's walking up and down on the gravel path, Captain Haldane said, "Well, I'll go and ask the commander-in-chief and see what he says." Churchill had continued pacing back and forth by himself until Haldane returned with the news that Lockhart had decided to add another orderly officer to his staff and Churchill was to fill the position. And so here was a man, a young aide-de-camp, that helped him get ahead, he sought out the help. And this aide-de-camp really had no reason to do what he did, but obviously he must have seen something in Churchill that could be used. It says, after that first meeting, Churchill had joined Haldane every day on his morning walk, and a friendship had quickly developed between the two young men. Although he thought Haldane a clever, daring, conscientious, and ambitious fellow, Churchill was baffled by his willingness not just to help him, but to go out of his way to open doors and clear paths. The success which has attended my coup is in some measure, I feel, deserved. Churchill had written to his mother after winning the argument with Lockhart, but I have received a most remarkable assistance from Captain Haldane, the general's ADC. I have never met this man before, and I am at a loss to know why he should have espoused my cause with so strange an earnestness. Now, I have my suggestion on this is that sometimes God does intervene in our lives, and he brings the right things into our lives to get us to move forward. And I think that's happened with Churchill many times. And we know that Churchill escaped being brutalized in war. Bullets would fly back his head and miss him. People would be shooting at him. And, it never got him. And it's the same thing with Donald Trump. Two people have tried to assassinate him. Two people failed. And one was just a turn of a head and looking a different way. The ear was hurt, but not the brain. And so God will do that for all of us if we just put our faith and trust in him. Now, Candace goes on to say, despite his skepticism, Churchill had not hesitated to take advantage of the situation and to ask Haldane for any favors he thought might be within his power to grant. So, now that sounds like Churchill. Well, thanks for doing this, but hey, can you do some more? Can you get some more things for me? And here's what he asked for. Now, this is maybe this is the vile part of Churchill. I'll say that to Karen. Maybe it is the vile part. But he said, he goes on to say, this is what he says to Haldane. He says, I am entitled to a medal and two clasps from my gallantry for the hardships and dangers I encountered while in India. He had written to Haldane soon after leaving for the Sudan. Now remember, in the Sudan, he also fought a great war, you know, in Egypt. He says, I am possessed of a keen desire to mount the ribbon on my breast while I face the dervishes here. It may induce them to pause. If you will do for me a favor and materially add to my joy as well as to my gratitude, please write me a letter to say exactly when I may consider my medal as issued and enclose in the envelope a little slip of ribbon. So now that takes a lot of guts, you know. Not only do I want a medal, but could you give me the ribbon too? You know, anyway, but Churchill and Haldane were good friends. He says, although in the intervening year, Churchill and Haldane had both moved quickly between countries and continents, and Churchill had left the army for his political campaign, they had somehow stayed in touch. Churchill had sent Haldane a copy of the River War and had made plans to see him again. Well, shall we meet anon? Piccadilly or the Pyramids? And had even introduced him to his mother, but having grown used to encountering people who were offended by his brash pride and obvious ambition, and who wished to knock the rungs out of the ladder he was so determined to climb, he continued to wonder why Haldane would wish to help him and ask for nothing in return. The only answer that made sense to him was that it must be the strength of his own resume. My idea is that reputation, for whatever it may be worth, has interested him. Churchill had speculated to his mother, of course you will destroy this letter and show it to no one, or I may be found as a fool as well as an ingrate. Churchill had a really close relationship with his mother, and she was there to help him all the way. Churchill had known that Haldane was already in Africa, but until the moment he had known nothing more. Even if his friend was not lying under the stony soil, Churchill was not likely to see him or be able to rely on his help, which he needed now more than ever. And this is why he needed the help. Remember now, he's not there as a soldier. Candace Miller goes on to say, as a non-combatant, unattached to the regiment, and with no official status beyond his assignment with the Morning Post and his letter of introduction from Chamberlain, he would have a difficult time getting anywhere near the front, which was exactly where he planned to be. This was quickly shaping up into a war that not only would sell newspapers, but could make heroes of men and members of parliament out of heroes. So remember, now this is always in the back of his mind. Sure, he was going to make a lot of money. Sure, he was a good writer, but he wanted to be seen as a hero. And that's really what he wanted. Now, he's not going to give up on that. So this is the next morning now, after they finally docked in Cape Town. Churchill immediately realized that he was not going anywhere quickly with Buller. Buller did not like him. As he learned early in his military career, although the picture of war moves very swiftly, the British Army does not. In the midst of the pomp and circumstance that surrounded Buller's arrival, a thundering salute from the harbor batteries, the streets lined with bunting-covered homes and cheering expatriates, the sluggish, overburdened machine that was the British military struggled to shake off the lethargy of the long voyage and shudder to life. And here Churchill, he's got a good friend that's been helping him. Now he's tussling with Buller, and he's still working hard to get that front position in the war. This paragraph goes on to say, even for England, used to dispersing its troops to the furthest reaches of its empire, it was no small undertaking to fight a war some 7,000 miles from home. In the month of October 1899, alone, including the men that Churchill was accompanying on the Dunodder Castle, the British Empire sent nearly 30,000 soldiers and officers to southern Africa. By March 1900, more than 160,000 men, an average of over 1,000 a day, would set sail from either Great Britain or Ireland, and that was just the troops. In comparison to the astonishing mobile Boers, who were able to wage war with little more than men, horses, and Mausers, and to move from battlefield to battlefield at a moment's notice, the British Army moved at a glacial pace, weighed down by the sheer number of its possessions. As one after another ships left Southampton, their cargo holds were filled with thousands of firearms, carbines, pistols, and rifles with long bayonets, as well as huge pieces of artillery, everything from 15-pounders, which took their name from the 15-pound shrapnel shells they shot, to short-barreled howitzers, which lobbed gunpowder-filled cast iron shells. There were hundreds and thousands of water bottles and bars of soap, thousands of tents and wagons, and hundreds of camp kettles. So there's, it's kind of like, you know, Candace is not necessarily mocking them, but they took their houses with them when they went to war, basically. That's what she's saying. It says, even clothing as men was a complicated and time-consuming task for the British Army. While the Boers were lucky to have any coat at all, Her Majesty's forces had the latest in rain gear to protect them from the South African summer downpours. The British clothier Thomas Bewbury had developed a new fabric called gabardine, a chemically processed wool that would repel rain and was resistant to tears. The soldier in the Boer War would be the first to wear jackets made from this fabric, which they called Burberrys. 15 years later, Burberry would design another coat for soldiers in World War I, with straps on the soldiers for their epaulets, the brass D-rings on the belt for their swords and hand grenades. Because most of the men wearing it would not be fighting in the trenches, it was called a trench coat. So here she's talking, you know, quite a bit about the weak. There's a strength to the British troops, but their weakness is they always had to look great, no matter where they were. They had to look great. They wanted their wives with them. They wanted parties. They wanted all that. This is really important for everyone, I think, that we're working with this to understand what it was really like to be in the British Army. I'm not going to read all of this right now. You can read page 82 and 83 yourself. Again, it's not just important to the story I want to get across to you today, and it's I'm really trying to kind of get you ready for the next program. Okay, she goes on to say, Candace goes on to say, this is page 83, to carry all these supplies, the British Army had brought 640,000 pounds worth of mules and oxen, ordered just weeks earlier to carry their men. They had been forced to ship hundreds of thousands of horses to South Africa, not just from England, but from Europe, North and South America, and Australia. For the horses, the journey by sea was even more miserable than it was for Churchill. In an attempt to keep them calm and less inclined to kick as they were forced onto the ships, they were kept rather low in flesh, deprived of food and water for hours before embarking. The handlers kept the horses' shoes on so that they had a better chance of staying upright in rough seas as they slid and skidded in their wooden stalls, but also it was assumed that they would be mounted as soon as the ship landed, which they always were. Those who survived that journey had little hope of returning home alive after the war. In fact, the average life expectancy of a horse in South Africa during the Boer War was 6 weeks. Most were killed by bullets, disease, overwork, or starvation, but occasionally during sieges they were eaten by soldiers who boiled their meat down to a paste and drank it like beef tea. All right, that's kind of gross. I didn't eat lunch yet today, so I'm going to not think about that. But let's go on now. It says, the crowd in Cape Town watched in excitement as Buller's own Irish chargers, Biffin and six-year-old white-faced chestnut and ironmonger A dark bay with white star on his forehead were lifted off the Donnotar castle at one time, secured in white leather harnesses and lowered down into a scene of complex chaos. Buller himself, leaving in his wake a staggering amount of work to accomplish, was whisked away in an open carriage, chased by cheering crowds to an urgent meeting with Sir Alfred Milner, the governor of Cape Colony. In other words, you know, in some ways, Candace is giving us a mocking history of the British Empire. And in some ways, I think we ought to be able to see where, you know, Winston Churchill could be a little bit frustrated with what's going on. And remember, he was a different kind of guy. And, it is really, really, really quite interesting. Winston, we can just summarize this a little bit. Winston needed to get help to the front, and of course the person he needed was killed, and so that didn't happen. And then Winston, remember, was not going anywhere with Buller. And so when I look at my time is running out, but this is a really good program, I think, for you to be able to listen to. And I know when I was out at our, you know, church convention in Florida, a lot of the brethren came up to me and told me how much they really liked the podcast. But then a few of them said to me, "Yeah, we always listen to you when we're going to bed." And I went, "When you're going to bed?" And they said, "Yeah, because your voice puts us to sleep." And I went, "Well, you gotta be listening to literature too. Come on, it's important." Well, that's all the time I have for today's program. Now, on our next program, we are going to finish discussing Candace Millard's book, Hero of the Empire, Part 2, Into Africa, Chapter 7. Now, the end of this chapter reveals Winston's dangerous plan to enter the Boer War. So you have to listen to this. Now, I promise you, we will finally stand on the battlefield with the British and the Boers and our hero, Winston Churchill. So this is a wonderful book. It's a supplement to Churchill's book, My Early Life. So you can buy a new or used copy of Candace Millard's book at Amazon.com. You may be able to find a copy in your local bookstore. And of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcug.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. And by the way, you can comment in Facebook as well. So simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.